Hi everyone, my name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, The Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. The other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. We could really use the help. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything, too. That small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
Before we get started here, though, I want to tell you about our new monthly guidebook / workbook called The Motivated Musician. It's geared towards serious musicians, and it offers challenges, exercises, professional advice, and more to help keep your career and your musical life on track. Also, as an extra perk, members get exclusive discounts from MyMusicMasterclass.com. So if you want to learn more, go to MyMusicMasterclass.com and you'll see the subscribe link in the menu. Click that and you'll be good to go. Hey all, we are here today with the saxophonist and clarinetist and composer, John Ellis, amazing player. And he also has a great video on My Music Masterclass, but John is a great guy and an amazing player, and he has some really cool history. And I believe he's an expert juggler. Like, were you, let's start with that, even before we ask how you're doing. So, like, I know that you said that you were a professional juggler. Was that a gig?
Isn't that how we found him? He was on my juggle masterclass.
I had a summer job. Yeah. I mean, my juggling masterclass would probably be a smart thing for me to be doing now.
Just extra income.
Yeah. Juggling is a good thing to do when you're stuck in the house. But yeah, no, I had like a summer job when I was 16 at a theme park called Carowinds, which is on the North Carolina, South Carolina border. It's funny. There was two of us that were jugglers, and I always wondered what happened to the other guy, because he was like infinitely better than me. But it was fun. We had a good time, and it was actually interesting, because at the time I was already into music, right. So the juggling thing was something I had just learned to kind of entertain myself in the country growing up. And but this guy was like he was like the artist juggler,
right?
So we were like entertaining these people.
He studied classically,
but kind of, you know, like, so he had this. But it was interesting because he had this, you know, thing where we had to go out and kind of essentially busk in this theme park.
Right.
And
I see.
And his thing was like, these knuckleheads, they don't appreciate how great I am. You know, there's a lot of parallels to music, you know, he's these guys, they don't appreciate. And he was right, actually. But then I didn't really care. So somehow I would end up with better crowds than him sometimes, because I like was just like doing the juggling thing, which was something I was not invested in at all. So
right.
I was like entertaining the people. But
right. That, you know, is very, that's very, a very, fun. Actually, that's a deep parallel to music.
It's a very funny parallel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're doing like the Taylor Swift covers of juggling. Exactly.
I was totally into it. I was doing it. Yeah. I was like this, like, I didn't care at all. Yeah. I was just like, whatever.
This is hilarious. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, look at me. I'm juggling. How insane is this?
Did you juggle anything sharp or fiery?
He did more of that. I didn't own those things. I think I did try to juggle his knives. Oof. You know, they're the ones he had, at least they're like, once you can do club juggling, it's not so, your hands are really, like, they're kind of soft, actually. Like, the way that you're interacting with the pins and everything, like, you're really unlikely to hurt yourself. And they were pretty dull. Like, they weren't like a...
Yeah.
It wasn't so dangerous as it might look, at least the ones he had. Mm-hmm. And even the fire, like if you touch it for a second, like you're gonna be all right, basically. Right.
I mean, you're more like cradling, right? Kind of like catching.
Yeah. It's a very soft catch to keep everything moving. So it's not, you know, it would have to be, and those knives generally are just, they're not sharp, super sharp. I mean, sometimes people show you that they are. So, but I mean, the ones that most people are using are not really that sharp.
Sweet. So you heard it here. Juggling knives. Go do it, kids.
Go do it.
Especially,
yeah, you got to get the special knives. Don't just go in the drawer. Don't just go in your parents' knife drawer.
Just get a chef's knife. Nah.
No, don't get the chef's knife. Definitely not.
You have an interesting musical journey. I guess that's the right word for it, because I know a lot of guys. And before I really knew you and talked to you about this, I thought you were a New Orleans cat, and right. I think some people think you are a New Orleans cat, and rightfully so. You spent a bit of time there, but you're from North Carolina, and you moved to New Orleans because of Ellis Marsalis, was it originally? Or
yeah, I went to school. I transferred from the North Carolina School of the Arts in my second year of college to go to school at University of New Orleans, and there was a. There were other guys from North Carolina that were also doing that, like who were older than me. So I kind of followed them. You know, Ellis had a really great program there. It was really apprenticeship based. There was a lot of opportunities to play. It was a small program. I was kind of, even all the way back then, I just didn't want to go to a big jazz school. I didn't want to go to Berkeley or, it just felt, I felt like I would get lost at a place like that. It just didn't have a lot of appeal to me. So this was kind of perfect, small, you know, very apprenticeship oriented. I got to play with Ellis a lot. It was really great. It was a great thing. So yeah, I went there for that. And then I didn't stay in school very long. That was actually, you know, unfortunately that happened a lot too, where we would get people would come down there to study with Ellis and then end up like taking a semester off or taking some years off. Just because we started playing so much, and that's kind of what happened to me. I didn't finish school until I came up to New York and I finished up the new school.
I'd imagine you'd have so much to work on too. So it's like you get all this stuff, and then you're like, "All right, I'm gonna go play and then practice. Like I don't need to be at school." You know what I mean? Like there's just so much information.
Yeah, totally. And to his credit, like he wasn't running it like a factory, or it was like. A lot of the stuff was very like Socratic, and you know, there was a lot of just open acknowledgement that like having a degree wasn't necessarily going to mean a lot for being hired to play music if that's what you wanted to do.
It's what you can do, what you actually do on stage, and
Ellis was
what your language knowledge is.
Exactly. You know? And he was a really great educator because he was just so real and such a mentor. You know, just he was amazing.
So when did you get to New York? And then like 97 or something like that?
97, yeah.
Yeah.
February.
All right. So you got to New York in 97. And what do you think the major difference kind of New Orleans was to New York? Or what do you love about New Orleans? And also, you know, do you go back often or plan to?
Yeah. I mean, those are super great questions. So I go back a lot less. And I regret that. When I first came to New York, I'm sure a lot of people who moved to New York from smaller places can sort of identify with this. But when I first came to New York, I was like, I'm just going to see how it goes. You know, I'll just try to see maybe 2 or 3 years. And I was like, well, then maybe I can do 5 years. No, okay, well, I did 5 years and maybe I'll... It was always like that. It was always like it seems to be... I've survived another 6 months and let me see what I can do now. So in my back pocket was always like, oh, well, there's New Orleans. I could go back to New Orleans because I was really comfortable there. And then the time just kept stretching out further and further. And then it sort of seemed a little bit harder to imagine going back. But during all those first years, I would go back really often, sometimes 3 or 4 times a year. And I was still playing with people that I had started playing with when I was down there. Especially at that time, I like to think of myself as like a cross-pollinator, you know, so I was trying to be connecting the people that I love playing with in New Orleans with people here, and I always felt like the two cities, they basically complemented each other in kind of awesome ways, like sort of everything that New York is, New Orleans is not, kind of, and vice versa, and there was something about that I thought was really healthy, like if you have too much of one, you go to the other one, and you kind of like it completes you, like whatever's missing is kind of there and then you go back. So that's kind of how I was feeling about it, at least during all of those initial years. It's, you know, New Orleans is much, much, much smaller. It's a place with like a tremendous amount of like local pride of self. And I think because of its history and how important it is in the music, sometimes we forget how small it actually is. You know, it's quite small. But music is so important there. There's all these like family, you know, dynasties, and there's an informality, there's a welcoming kind of community feeling in the music. Like there's kind of like, oh, you play music? Oh, come play with us. You know, oh, you want to? Oh, come on. You know, there's tons of jam sessions and tons of playing for parties and playing for functions and playing for people dancing. But it felt very inclusive, you know? And then like up here, it's like, oh, you play music? Well, sit down. This is my thing. This is my, you know, back off. Get away from me. I carved out my space. This is my space. This is sort of the exclusive thing. I'm an artist. You know, this is about my art. You know, down there, it's like, oh, just everybody's involved. I mean, it's funny because I thought about that sometimes with like free music scene down there, because there was kind of a pretty interesting like free jazz scene. But like the guy would come from, you know, trombone player just played like 3 gigs that day, and one of them was like a trad gig at the Palm Court, but now he's playing free jazz. And even the free jazz had like a come on, let's be free together. Like it's right. It didn't have that like back up off of me, you know, like that kind of pushing you away feeling. So
that also is kind of just a New York vibe aside from music, you know what I mean? It's very
right.
It's in its lane, you know.
Exactly. And I think it also has to do with like how many people there are here, how big the music scene is here. And it's like, oh, I've got to carve out my little space. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always felt like, well, if New York becomes too daunting or too impenetrable, I know that like New Orleans was very kind to me. You know, on the other hand, I felt like that the smallness of it, as much as I loved that, I also felt like I needed the stimulation of more things happening, more interaction. I mean, just in some ways, just getting my ass kicked so much more here. So I feel like that has always been really healthy. And then you know how it is, like you just get used to being somewhere, and now it's hard for me to imagine really being anywhere else. I mean,
musically, do you feel that the city influenced your playing at that time? You know, I know that you came in, what, you were 16 or 18 when you got there, and you were only there for several years before you went to New York, but do you feel that the city itself, the sound of and the feel got into your playing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also important to think about, you know, where I came from. Like, I came from a very small town in North Carolina, like a very rural, basically, North Carolina, and there was, you know, congregational church singing, and you know, it was like a southern music kind of experience. So I think
you're already used to laid back.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, New Orleans, and that's part of why I went. I actually thought about trying to come to New York instead of going to New Orleans, but New York was too overwhelming for me, and New Orleans felt like familiar in certain ways. You know, it was something about New Orleans that felt more comfortable and more, yeah, I mean, those things really, really did influence me, but I think I was already sort of, there was a naturalness about my connection to New Orleans because of where I was coming from that I really actually didn't have trying to come straight to New York. So yeah, I mean, I think that that music influenced me a lot, but it also just kind of felt more like home in an easy way. You know, where here I felt like I was just getting smacked around all the time, but I sort of started to get used to that and like it, I guess.
Yeah. You've definitely done a lot of work here. You know, well, you play with John Patitucci and Lonnie Smith, I know, and, you know, and Miguel Zenon and a bunch of, you know, you're always working as on a sideman note. Right. And I know that you have that really cool band called Double Wide, which is really New Orleans based, right?
Yeah, it's sort of like the extension of that idea of cross-pollinating. I mean, it's hybrid.
Okay.
It's extremely impractical, but yeah, it came from because people live in different places, so it's not easy to do anything. That's small, but
it's actually just as practical as anything else.
I know we should be trying to do stuff. I reached out to them. We should be trying to do things. No, I kind of built it around this sousaphone virtuoso that I had played some gigs with named Matt Perrine. And I felt like he just had some special gifts, and the fact that he was doing all the stuff on the sousaphone was just sort of, I don't know, it gave any music you did with him kind of this special, interesting, different thing. And he's based in New Orleans, and it made it like a New Orleans project. But it wasn't, it's always been kind of, I've basically written all the music for it. So it's always just kind of like this hybrid stuff.
So let's move on to now, I guess. I mean, what are you doing right now in COVID? You know, I mean, with the semi-quarantine or full quarantine that we're in, I mean, as you know, because you're in my area, we are legally allowed to remove ourselves from the house, but it doesn't really do much. You know, I mean, there's not that much work going on. Have you been doing some of those live stream gigs or?
I finally did one. I did one at Smalls.
Right.
Last Friday with Mike Rodriguez. And it was amazing. It was sort of like, to have the feeling of playing with people was pretty exhilarating and kind of terrifying, you know, everything. But also just but it's weird, you know, because there's nobody there.
Yeah.
I think the live stream thing is very funny because I was trying to explain this and find the right words for it. But, you know, we played in rehearsals and in sessions. You know, I've been doing that my whole life, you know, and I love that. Like, I love playing just us without an audience. Maybe I enjoy that more than I should. You know, I mean, I know some of us are addicted to the audience. Like, I like the audience, but I also like it sometimes without the audience. And, but there's something about like in your physical space, there's no audience. And yet you have to imagine that there's this virtual space where there maybe is an audience, right?
Yeah.
And it's
silently judging.
Yeah. But you don't get any energy from that. You know, like you don't, it's like they tell you, well, we're streaming, but you don't see it. Like,
there's
you don't
no,
see
like, red light that goes on or anything. Like
yeah,
that.
I mean, at least down there. I mean, you don't know. Like, maybe they're not streaming, right? I mean, it's like the difference between
if a tree falls in the woods, right?
It's a little bit like that. It's hard to explain, like how. But then you have this in your mind, like, oh yeah, but there's an audience, so we should be. It's like, the whole virtual thing is actually it's very weird. You know, it's like okay, well, we should pretend as if. So it's neither the thing when you have this intimate thing by yourself. Even though that's what it feels like it is. It's neither that nor having an audience
right.
physically with you. It's like some other, you know, netherworld.
The MC thing must be a little weird too, because you guys are discussing personally what tunes you want to do next maybe, and you should probably say that on the mic, you know? Right, things like just like all that stuff is just weird.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I was leading, I mean, I thought Mike did a great job of like kind of navigating. He's treated it more, you know, more professionally like a gig. I think if I was leading, I would be more casual about it because I would forget that I probably would be like, I don't know, what do you guys want to do?
I gotta take a piss, just give me
should we go get a slice?
You have like Vanna White like pointing at a set list. Let's do this next song.
Yeah.
I think I just aged myself. Vanna White.
Vanna White. Wow. I'm there with you.
She was my fave. Yeah.
We must all be the same age. Oh man. Yeah. So I don't know what else to say about what I'm doing. I mean, I'm also doing my first strange recording.
How strange?
It's with Darcy James Argue's band, and it's actually kind of brilliant that he was able to salvage this gig. We were supposed to have a gig in California in October, so it couldn't happen for obvious reasons, but Darcy's very ambitious and he has these multimedia pieces. And this one is it's actually all about conspiracy theory in American political history, which is, you know, he did it in 2015, but it's like more timely every day. And so, but he figured out a way because of how we had made the recording of this project. It's called Real Enemies, but he figured out that because all the solos were done, in isolation booths, but basically he could have everybody play new solos and create kind of a new experience for people. But even in the time of COVID, they could have like something. And it's like a gig. It's hard for me to really understand exactly how the audience is going to receive.
Is it almost like interactive for them?
I don't know exactly. I just
like
know that.
Choose your own story kind of thing.
Well,
mirror episode.
That would be cool. I think it's actually because of the multimedia aspect. I think it does tell us kind of a narrative story. And so, But for us, like what it means practically for us in the band is that we all, what makes it kind of a weird recording session from my perspective is that something unimaginable before COVID really is that it's a full big band, but we all record one at a time. And then they disinfect everything, and they, you know, and then like the next person comes in before. And so, you know, I imagine it being like those briefings, you know, those Fauci briefings where like the team comes and cleans the mic, and yeah, you have your moment without a mask where you're like, right, playing your solo, and then the next
like
person
blast comes. Lysol into the air,
like, whatever.
Like,
yeah,
a coughing fit before you're trying to play.
I know. Yeah, you hope you don't, right? You're like, oh man, it's allergies. No, trust me.
Exactly.
It's very legit, this one. I mean, they have a you know, it's a production team, and they required everyone to get tested, so it's more,
it's great.
Yeah, it's more like a job, real job.
What are you doing to keep yourself sane? And do you do any exercise or meditation, or do you have any projects or hobbies?
Well, I exercise a lot, and more than I was doing before, partly because my schedule is now not so filled with things, and partly because my lady is well, she's working from home, and like I said, we're in a studio apartment, but she is a very disciplined exerciser, so I'm doing more. Just we go for runs, we go along the East River, and we run about 4 or 5 times a week, and so that's helpful. That's extremely helpful. I mean, weirdly, I'm probably in better health, better physical health than I usually am.
Right.
And then I'm practicing. You know, it's funny. Everybody does these things differently. Somehow, you know, when I started in the beginning, probably a lot of people have this experience. I say the first couple of months, it was like there's something kind of exhilarating in the, there was like the tragedy all around, and there was like the heartbreak and the fear. But then there was also something in the music where it was like a sort of newness, like the exciting kind of like, oh, everything is new, and we can just create this new thing, and we can try to collaborate. You know, it was kind of a something I thought that was actually in the context of all of this terror and sadness. There was also something kind of liberating and beautiful in the music, in the approach towards music. And then I found that after a little, you know, after a couple of months, just kind of slowly waned. And the trajectory moves more towards this sort of like doldrums and sadness, and, you know, and like hard to motivate and hard to figure out, you know, and sort of like listlessness, mm-hmm, directionless, you know, like those.
I think it's a, you know, future warning of like, we shouldn't be all digital, which is, you know,
I mean, I think
some people wish we were, like in the video game world, that's definitely been something that they've been living in for years. You can look into that whole situation.
Right.
Like people have been living online for over a decade now.
Yes.
But like, it's just not fun enough for me.
I mean, there may be a state. I mean, I think we're in the stage that we're in from a technological standpoint. Like, you know, like the latency issues mean that, yes, people are using Jack or whatever. And I mean, you can do some sort of amorphous, you know, not totally rhythm-based stuff with a tremendous amount of work and technological know-how. But like, you know, the bandwidth issue is real. The latency issues are real. You can't really play with people. But, you know, I could imagine a future world once VR, you know, really starts to take hold. And I mean, that all that technology is still pretty new and pretty, you know, is obviously going to keep growing. Mm-hmm. And there may be a version of pandemic in the future that where this works better. But like currently, yeah, what we have now, as amazing as it is, considering like what they had in 1918, but I mean, it's still pretty insufficient. You
know? It's not
it's
a
still
replacement.
A tool. It's still just a tool. It's not life.
I mean, I was saying this in the last podcast we just did, Pete Bernstein, and we were talking about a friend of mine just started using this software. It's called Jam Kazam, and he swears by it in terms of having usable latency, but you need to have an Ethernet port. And if you're on Wi-Fi, it fucks the whole thing up.
I mean, right.
But, you know, that's promising. You know, the concept being, I haven't tried it, but he says that he does it and it's really not even noticeable latency.
Really?
So that's from his mouth. I have to try it and see that. But I didn't have a wired connection the day that he wanted to try it with me. But it's something I'm going to check out. And if that's possible, you know, maybe we're only years away from having something that's usable. via Wi-Fi because, you know, I mean, Elon Musk is throwing Starlink satellites up. You know, it's all going to get there, you know.
Of course. No, I do think that the trajectory is sort of undeniable. And then also the VR thing, if you have like really immersive.
So dope.
Yeah, I mean, we could also like that whole thing I was describing earlier about the live stream. I mean, you could imagine that there's an audience element, even though it's a virtual audience, mm-hmm. through a kind of immersive VR experience that starts to feel a little bit more.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I mean, that's going to be exciting. And I think there's something inevitable about that trajectory.
There's this, I don't know if you watch Black Mirror, but there was this super dark episode in, I think, season one where everything is VR, you know, it's the future and it's this dystopic, like, technological.
That's where on the bikes, where he's on the bike.
Yes.
You build the points. Oh, yeah, I saw that one. That one is so dark. So
dark. But, like, you know, at that point, like, there, it's basically this American Idol type of competition.
And oh, my
the
God.
The audience is virtual and they're just like avatars of themselves. Yes. Yeah, but the end result of that, it was an excellent episode, but so dark. Just fucked me up.
Everybody, that stuff for hours, man.
Everybody told me about Black Mirror. I actually didn't see very many of it, but I watched the first few. And everybody was like, man, you will love it. You will love it. Because I've kind of been a sort of a tech skeptic for a long time. And I was like, oh, man, you'll love it. But then I watched, like, I have to, like, watch one and then stop for like a few weeks, you know? like it's not something you can really just like, oh, let's watch another one. You can't really I can't binge that stuff. It's like, well,
there are some that are lighter, you know, they do it so that like every third one is pretty light and cool,
okay,
but then they go into something that just destroys you and you say, oh my God, if that happens in the future, we're just ruined, you know.
Yeah, and they're also plausible, like they're so also plausible. Like, yeah, basically that's we're pretty much there. I mean, that's how it feels. They're like, oh,
yeah, we feel like 10 years away from all those episodes pretty much.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't feel far away.
It's so good.
Yeah.
It is painful.
There's been two quantum computers at USC down the street for a good decade now. So,
oh,
yeah.
Wow.
they're doing some shit. Like, things are going down.
Yeah, those quantum computers, you know, just once it turns into a smartphone,
I can get all the pickup lines simultaneously, every possible pickup line. That's what I'll use it for.
Yeah, that's the problem, right? We have the technology and don't have any good ideas.
No, exactly.
Great, amazing technology and like don't know what to do with it.
I'm just going to bother women with it.
Yeah, right. I think we're already like sort of like that.
So before you play in a normal world, COVID-less, mm-hmm. like what's your routine for kind of staying sane on the road and just kind of, I don't know, keeping your health and your mental health while traveling and gigging and doing a lot of work? Because you're a busy person.
Yeah.
Or are you just always eternally grateful for playing? You know, some people are.
I think that I try to be. I don't succeed at that all the time, but I know that that's the right space to be in, and I feel healthier when I'm in that space. I mean, you know, it's, touring is tiring. It's physically exhausting. It's like I'm definitely old enough and have done it long enough that the kind of like, oh my God, it's so exciting. We're going somewhere. That part has worn off to a certain degree. I mean, maybe this will reset, you know, and we'll be all excited again. I mean, I have been kind of happy to not have to get on the airplane during all this time, to be totally honest.
Especially now. But, I mean, that's just stressful as shit.
Yeah, I mean, and also just I was doing it so much, and I was, you know, I actually went to China twice last year.
Yeah, quite a plane ride.
And I went once and I went to Singapore separately from that, and I went once for like less than a week, and we had one-nighters. We went to like two, couple of gigs in Taiwan, and a couple of gigs, three gigs in China.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's like that kind of stuff is crazy. I would say that, you know, I slowly learned a few things that work better for me. I went to my doctor and we were talking about stuff, and she was like, "No, have you ever tried compression socks? Because you're on the plane all the time." And I was like, "I don't need that. That's like, you know, older people." And she was like, "Seriously, you should try it." And I was like, "Really?" And I bought some compression socks, like some good ones.
Yeah.
I should have done that like 15 years ago. There's no age that's too young for like transatlantic flights. Compression socks are so great.
Besides making your feet not hurt, does it do anything else? Or is that pretty
much it? Because it's circulation. Mm-hmm. It actually, I thought it was just like that. Like, it's like, oh, I'm not going to, my feet won't be swollen. But that's part of it. But I also, was noticeably just less worn out, you know, like less. Yeah. Like sometimes I get up to play, I feel like I just came out of a meat grinder or something. Like I just had a little less of that. I felt like
shit,
just not as beat up, you know? And it's like, wow, this is kind of the easy kind of hack that I should have been doing all along. The other thing that I learned is that I also, the whole experience is better if I don't drink on the plane.
Agreed, which, but it's hard to avoid sometimes.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I used to be like, oh, I'm on the plane. Part of being on the plane. It's like, I'm gonna have a drink. And I just realized that, like, you know, I like to have a drink. And, you know, I can just do that after. But I feel like if I'm drinking on the airplane, I basically just stop. I stop doing that. And that makes a huge difference. It's not such a big, you know, difficult thing. But I feel like that sometimes just the traveling is so hard that it's just worth it to do those little things.
Well, you get hit with the booze so hard up there that it just, it's crazy.
I know. And you feel like, oh, this is cool. It's like, it's free. Like that part of your mind where you're like, oh, they're giving me drinks.
It does slam you about three times the potency because of your altitude.
Yeah, it's just.
Well, and you're not moving. Like your body's not meant to be trapped like that.
It's just basically like a, you know. You learn a little things that work for you. And for me, compression socks and not drinking on the airplane were big discoveries. So I was like, okay, this is actually quite a bit better. And then the other simple thing is just, you know, I think you're just mostly just try to exercise if you can. As much as it's possible to exercise, that always helps. And then you just have to try to eat, you know, decent. I feel like it's just all really super basic. Basic things, but surprisingly important for traveling that much.
Yeah. And eating is difficult if you're on the road. I mean, depending on where you are. If you're in certain countries or areas, it's easy to get healthy food or good food for you, you know. But sometimes when you're just doing truck stops, it's not as easy, you know.
Totally. I mean, I also just, I kind of sleep. Like, I have a lot of friends that they always try to outsmart the jet lag. You know, they're like, just take half of the little melatonin, like that. If you just take half of that, you take this. For me, I've never been able to do it. I try to just submit, you know. I just try to be like, if I'm tired, you know, I pretty much go to sleep. If I have to, I mean, most of the time you have to work, so you're just forced to get on track at some point anyway. So, but I try to let myself sleep if I'm like that.
Yeah, I mean, you start taking drugs, now you're on another schedule. Now it's like, what? Like, now you have to take that again. And it's, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just
like,
the whole thing of
just go natural.
Yeah, I just feel like you can't really outsmart it. Like, you just got into a thing with wings and you went way farther than humans are supposed to go that fast. And you just have to sort of like navigate. I try not to outsmart it too much. I try not to be like, oh, if I just drink like a, you know, like 18 coffees and maybe I'll, you know, it's like everything that I've tried, every time I've tried to do that, it just makes everything worse.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you're on the road, do you practice at all? I mean, I know you can't really do it in hotels. Or do you just kind of get to the venue and try to find a spot, or are you just keeping your chops together?
I wish I could practice more on the road. I never figured it out. I do find that sometimes I can do other creative things better. Like, you know, I have a little small, you know, octave and a half MIDI keyboard, and sometimes I can write. Like, usually I can do it if I have a deadline, you know, but I can generate seeds of things. I would put it in that category. I don't really do, like, I can't really do anything that feels finished, but I can kind of create things like that.
You look forward to getting home.
Yeah, sometimes it's been like that. Sometimes I've needed to do that. So I don't do that as much as I would like to, but I can do some of that. If I can, I always try to figure out a way to practice. Usually I can go a little bit early, you know, but it's mostly just a maintenance type of, like, I just want to make sure that my read works and make sure that I feel comfortable and, you know, navigating whatever the altitude or whatever. I mean, practicing is something I just generally like to do. And, you know, especially like to have just my own space, you know, just by myself to do something. So I try to find out on the road if I can. Like, one of the gigs we did last year in China was great because it was at that Lincoln Center they have in Shanghai. And so I was able to go early pretty much every day, just play a little bit.
I mean, when you practice at home, do you do it at home or do you have another studio space?
I couldn't. Yeah. Luckily, I have a studio space that I share that's on the Lower East Side. I mean, currently it would be rough here because we live in a studio.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
so that's one way to get a breakup, you know.
Yeah, one way to get a breakup.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's good. It's good. It's like my rehearsal space is a 20-minute walk, and I go down there. It's been, you know, it's just clunky basement, but it's great. It's quiet. You know, like I've been able to make recordings there that sound good. You know, you could do all making these little videos for people and all that.
And you practice a lot now, or how many hours do you do it per week?
It depends. I lose days, but I try. I mean, I discovered a couple of things that I've been trying to figure out. Like basically, you know, for years I've had some pain, my shoulder and stuff, and that, you know, it's going to sound really weird, but basically like I've been really mostly lately thinking about the most fundamental stuff. Like how do you hold the instrument? Like what is the right height to hold it at?
Yeah.
And basically like how far do you put the neck strap and where, like just the really the most basic stuff, which is like, mm-hmm. has to do with it's kind of like using the neck strap to force yourself to have posture that's more efficient. And it's actually, it was clear once I started, got on this path, and I was like researching things on YouTube, and it was just clear that it was like the right thing to do. But it's also, it's very destabilizing to try to change something so fundamental as like, this is where how I play that. So, you know, this is the angle that the mouthpiece goes into my mouth.
Kind of. It sounds like Alexander technique almost.
It's kind of like something like that. And, but
it's
I also
natural
felt like
in the beginning, but you have to like retrain your body to do something.
Yeah. I mean, the cool thing is that, I've always been pretty crappy at like if people say, oh, you know, you should hold your head this way, or you should hold your shoulders this way. And I, you know, it always makes sense and sounds right to me, but then I can't remember. I can't make myself keep doing it. But with the saxophone neck strap, you have this advantage that if you're super conscious in the beginning about where you set it and it doesn't move, then that forces you, like you have to have good posture to actually play because mm-hmm. you've placed the neck strap in the right way. And, it's been very, very interesting, helpful. It's also probably not the kind of thing that I would have had the confidence to do were it not COVID-tized because, you know,
you wouldn't want to be trying that stuff out on the gig.
Yeah, because you feel different. You know, you feel like, oh, like as soon as you play, it's like not, things aren't happening the way you're used to.
Yeah. I mean, that's like why people don't switch right over to in-ears with gigs. Like it's like, dude, this is gonna be totally different. I need like a month to figure the shit out.
Exactly.
At least, you know?
Yeah, it's really
hard. A lot of
piano
players go through that shit too. I mean, Jeremy did a whole class on kind of when he took his time to sort of fix his posture, and that was a whole master class. I mean, it's endless stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
Because it can hurt you if you don't do it. You know?
It's the kind of thing where you're like playing one note and thinking about how your wrist does this and the tension in your shoulder, and it's
all of that.
It's kind of meditative too, you know. I mean, but you have to submit to it and not get frustrated.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
I mean, if you want to be shedding when you're like 70s, 80s, 90s,
well, that's
like cats,
right. That's
you got to do that shit.
Right. So I've been, you know, like I went to a chiropractor for like 7 months last year.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. It actually it helped me a lot. But it's also like, okay, well, clearly I'm doing something not so great. Like, how can I make sure that when I'm playing, because it's not just about the posture and the pain. I feel like that's also important, but it's also that it puts you in touch with the air. It puts you, it just actually you play the instrument better, basically. Yeah, like it's,
right.
So it's more about that. It's like, not only do you hurt less, but you actually just
do
more efficiently.
Like long tones when you're working on stuff like that to kind of like see if there's a big difference.
Well, I don't really AB it so much, but no, but I do. I mean, my main approach to trying to connect to the air has always been through playing the overtones. So like, nice. That's the thing that I do. And I do them as long tones sometimes, but I also do a lot of like, just playing, you know, just playing and playing things like I would have played normally and just trying to notice the how it feels different.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. The content, you know, like the content of what I'm actually playing, which I know is like a big part of like how the whole masterclass series and things, how important it is. It's an interesting thing to say, but like sometimes if I'm focused on something like breath and sound, the content becomes so secondary. Like I'm actually not, I'm like, I'm noticing all these little things about, like, okay, this is the articulation and this is the, but the kind of what it is I happen to be playing is like not really where my attention is, yeah. You know? So I'm just sort of thinking about range and like, does this work if it's low and high, and, you know, but I'm not really like in some kind of set grid of some kind of information.
So we've talked about a lot of different stuff, but do you ever get the question from your students or just from cats? It's the just the basic question of like what to do when you're coming up. Is that a question you get a lot? Do you have an answer you give kids or just younger players trying to get into the scene?
About career things?
Yeah, I mean, just to, you know, getting into the scene in New York, if they're asking about that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I get those questions a lot at master classes when you go to other schools and stuff. Mm-hmm. It seems like inevitably there's always a career question. So, you know, a social media question, or how did you get this or that? And I guess because I was never very strategic about those things, I find those questions really hard to answer. Like, I know that people have done lots of strategic things that have helped them, but, you know, I was essentially, I was super lucky in some ways, and that helped me not have to worry about it as much, I guess. But I was also like, you know, I didn't like launch to the top of anything. But, you know, I guess I feel like it depends on the person and it depends on how they ask it, how I would answer it. But, you know, I still feel like there's a few things that I think are important. Like, one is just appreciating that this music, like so many things, is basically social, and that you aren't going to be great, like, and just in your house and like, no one's going to come discover you. No one's going to be like, wow, that guy sounds so good at practice room. Like, he's going to have this opportunity. Like, most of the opportunities that people get are just because they're easy to be around. There's something about them that people like being around them, and they just are around. Like, they go support people. They go check out stuff. And so, you know, there are some times where a certain kind of hustling can work against you if you come across as being kind of like that, like a hustly guy, like jealous or envious, you know, those kinds of things. I think a lot of people can sense that on you, that you're there. You're like, oh, I wish I had that.
Totally. Yeah, but this is what I was talking about. See, I'm not talking about strategy. Like, this is just things that you think help people get into the scene. And I think that's true. Like, being cool is very important.
I mean, being cool, being supportive, like being, you know, and also just being present. Like, a lot of people that I know that are great and sometimes have turned a little bitter for various reasons, I feel like often, like, they, you know, and they're envious and, you know, this person's got this. Here's another thing that also everyone has a tendency to assume that someone's life is better than it actually is too, because, you know, that's what social media distorts everything. Everyone's like, oh my God, I'm doing this great thing. Oh, don't you wish you were doing this great thing I'm doing? So I think people have to learn how to be a little skeptical of that. But then also, like, it says so much that you just are present, that you check out what people are doing, and that you love it, and that you give people, you know, like, that you tell them that you love it, that you go, you know, that you go. I think if you do that and you're sincere and you work really hard and you sound really good, I think a lot of things work out. You know, I mean, you're not going to be at home. Stuff's not going to happen for you magically. I mean, maybe very rare exceptions. But
I always had a question for horn players. I don't think I've ever even asked anyone this, but like, is it important? Does it matter? Do you like try to go and get into like sectional playing? Like, do you get like some cats and kind of go latch on to stuff like that? Is that like a thing that people do?
It's like a section that would back artists. That would back,
if it's
like
pop, if it's R&B. I mean, because I feel like that gives you like a whole other strength that would be really useful.
Right. I think people have, I've never done that, but I have seen other people do it. And I think that could be really cool, actually. Yeah. I mean,
well, with Ian, you know, Ian Henderson Smith, you know, right. Him as well.
Sure.
He got that work out of another section. That when he was with Sharon Jones, him and
exactly.
That guy, like they get hired out because of that. It's not, I mean, he was always good in sections, you know, like they didn't go out to do that. They just, it became a thing.
But I mean, that helps with like arranging and shit, like tons of stuff, I would think.
Yeah. I think you can, like, it, for example, if you decided like, wow, that's my dream. I want to be in a section. And I think you certainly could try to organize something like that and make it happen. I would be unsure, like, how do you, you know, what would you present my general understanding of my friends that are in sections like that, or like for example, like Ian, yeah, like somehow you're friends with someone. This goes back to just like being around. You're like friends with someone, and then they say, "Oh, we're doing this thing," and then they, "Hey, man, do you want to make this gig?"
Yeah.
And then you, and a lot of that stuff seems like most of it happens sort of organically, and it just sort of grows out of a certain community thing.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, for like big bands, for the longest time when I was in New York, I didn't play in big bands. You know, I didn't particularly want to play in big bands, and I just, it just was not how my life sort of unfolded. So many things are just about sort of the circumstances. And then I ended up playing with somebody, I don't know if it's like Alan Ferber, or who is a friend of mine who wasn't doing big band, and then he started doing big band, and I was playing with him, and then you play with different people, and then the big bands are like that too. Like, oh man, this guy, he was in this big band, we should ask him, and you recommend, now you sub for this person, and now all of a sudden you know, like I played in Miguel Zenon's big band. I played with Darcy's big band. You know, I never had any ambition to play really in big band, but I do it just because I somehow ended up doing one, and then, oh, this guy, you know, he could be good.
So it is like a separate world. It's not like a rite of passage kind of thing for everyone. I just always kind of wondered like where that fit.
Big band?
Just like sections, big band, like all that kind of stuff, you know? I figured like maybe it was everyone had to go through like all that stuff, even if they're just going to be a soloist. And I just always kind of,
I mean, I think it used to be like that a lot more, right? Like I think there used to be all these bands and you had a lot of experience. You know, this is where the trombone thing is super interesting, because a lot of my best friends are trombone players, and some of my just favorite musicians who are just so well-rounded and great. And I think part of that is that trombone players, their work life, if they're going to work a lot, tends to be in groups. It tends to be in ensembles. It tends to be in groups of other trombone players. Like, so you have to be cool, you know, like you have to be cool, because otherwise it's a community and you hang, they all hang together, and they all, like, there's a kind of supportive vibe. Of course, there's, everybody's a little different, but like, you know, the general working opportunities for someone who plays trombone involve sort of being in a band, you know, being in a band, being in a section. And also because the instrument itself, where it sits in the frequency spectrum, like where it lives in the clef, is it's in between, right? It's like it plays a pivotal sort of supportive role. It's not super high, it's not super low. They sit in the middle of the band, in the big band, where they can hear everything. The trumpets are behind them, right? They're always in the middle.
Big range too.
They have a huge range, but they're always in the middle, and they're always like doing this really important, like subtle kind of badass
mid-voice stuff. Work.
And they have a thing with they don't have keys to press like us. Like we could just flap around
that shit, man.
They have like to actually. Shit.
Yeah,
it's super ninja. Like they're crazy. Yeah. They're like so understated, and like the badass ones are so crazy badass. Like they hear every little micro like tuning thing. You know, they're like, because they always have to adjust. It's funny, right? Like I think if you're a trombone player, like you naturally find yourself with a certain kind of personality ethos that has to do with like camaraderie and like making it work together, playing in sections. Whereas I think not all instruments sort of naturally lead you there.
It's interesting, man. You could probably say that there's a psychology to all instruments, right? Like bass players and drummers everyone has their vibe, you know, and there's jokes about all of them, and
jokes. Some of them are for good reason. Those jokes.
That's what I'm saying. You know what I mean? There's definitely personality types, and not everyone's going to fit into those molds, but there's something to it.
There is something. I mean, I think there's something about just the practical, like the practicality, like back to just talking about what working is like how do you work, whereas like surveying the landscape, right? So like, how do you work as a trombone player? Well, you're probably going to play in some kind of band, right? Like, so how do you work if you're, if you're a guitar player? Like, oh man, now you're going to probably play like lots of different styles of music if you're going to work a lot, right? You're not going to be just in kind of one thing. You're going to be influenced by like all these different worlds.
Probably.
Right?
I mean, there's exceptions, but most of the time,
sometimes the guitarists who like, they seem like they're on this one track, and when you talk to them, you're like, oh yeah, I really like stuff. They also like, they checked out some other stuff because they play guitar.
They're like, Rush is my shit.
Yeah, right? And you're like, really?
Yeah.
No, right? But it's like, I think it's, you know, and if you're a horn player, it's interesting. Like if you're a saxophone player, I think it, I always operated under the thinking that I would be the first one that you didn't need, right? Like in a band, it's like, okay, we need a bass for sure. Like we're going to have some kind of drummer. Chords would be nice, but it's like, you know, if it's a singer or something, do we really need a saxophone? We really need this guy. Like, budgets are low, you know, we have to make some cuts. Let's get rid of the saxophone. So I didn't ever feel, that's the irony that I've had this side in my career, because I actually never, from the beginning, I thought, well, I'm probably going to have to make my own stuff happen somehow, because the sideman world for saxophones seems so small. Like the opportunities are, there's not enough opportunities, especially given how many great players there are. I mean, there's like so many people that are great, and you're just like, okay, well. And I think I've always felt like, and I don't know if it's true, but I've always felt like it's because I felt that way, and because early on I made my own records and did a lot of writing stuff, but then I got hired as a sideman because people heard stuff I did, you know, like on my own projects and things like that. And that helped me like build something enough so that I could get hired with other people, which was not what I was thinking. I was thinking I wasn't going to get hired. But it's just sort of a strange phenomenon. That's what it seems like happened.
Yeah, man. So we've talked about a lot. And again, you know, thanks so much for coming on, man. And, you know, I hope that we're able to see some sense of normalcy in the future and to get live music back together. And wouldn't that be something?
That would be amazing. And I really appreciate you having me on. And I remember when we did that masterclass, we had like a great hang and a long talk about everything that day too. So.
Yeah, man. Well, again, John, thanks so much, man. And do you have anything that you want to push, like, you know, to tell the five people that are listening to this podcast?
I don't know. I mean, my latest, I have a couple records that came out like super recently. I did this, one of those jazz gallery commissions that we were speaking about before called the Ice Siren. That was took a long time to get together, but that finally came out. And it's pretty ambitious with the singers and strings and stuff. So
cool.
Please check that out. And then sort of like as a crazy compliment to that, I also have a trio record, which is bass and drums, called When the World Was Young.
Who's that trio?
That's basically my Philly family, Madison Rass and Anwar Marshall.
Nice.
They're both from Philadelphia, or they're both from Philadelphia. And I have, because pre-COVID, I was in this period where I wanted to record all the time. So I actually have multiple things still in the can that I've been meaning to finally get all completed. But
yeah, I remember rapping you with about that. You wanted to release something like weekly or something at one point.
Yeah, right? I was trying to do a song weekly, but now I've been thinking about I did that for a while, but now I'm just kind of organizing some of those sessions into, you know, what's more like an album.
Totally.
And and that's actually something that's a good reminder. I can get back to that. I have, there are a lot of things that are like in good shape, and it's, you know, not as easy to record with people now, but although I'm doing some of that, but it is pretty easy to obviously mix and master stuff.
Totally.
People are starting to get back in the studio.
I think there's happening. Yeah.
GB's joint over there.
Oh yeah.
I think Ian was just doing something there today.
Yeah. You can do it at GB's. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure he's down. Yeah. And the Blunker is doing stuff. Yeah. No, I'm supposed to record something next month with somebody, like an actual recording session. So.
Nice.
Yeah, people are itching to do things. It's just hard. You know, it's still hard. People still want to be safe. You don't want to just jump the gun and be a douchebag.
Mm-mm. Yeah, totally. Totally. And then there's a question of like, okay, so how do we pay for this again?
Exactly. Yeah. None of us are making money at the time, right?
Yeah, that's kind of that.
That's a trick. But man, thanks again. And we'll see each other on the other side, hopefully before.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. Keep in touch. Bye. Thanks, bro. All right.
See ya.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail. You can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformancepathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent, of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. So look forward to hearing from you.